everybody, and welcome to True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have not done one in a while. And I told you I was going to do one. I think the last time I was going to do one was about 2 weeks ago. And I was supposed to do one with these fine fellows last week, but I got food poisoning. And it was a doozy of a woozy of food poisoning. Anyway, I am here with these two wonderful men, Steve and Farber, and Michael McClellan. Hi, guys. Thanks for waiting and coming on again.
Hi, Grace. Good to be with you.
Yes, exactly.
I am so thrilled to have you on. And they wrote, this is, when I first saw the title, because I'm always thrilled when a new classic movie book comes out or something. You know, I love it. A, for the point that I love to read it. B, for the fact that if I love it, then I can ask if they'd like to come on the show. So it's double purpose. But when I read it, and the title of their book is Cinema 62, The Greatest Year at the Movies. Now, that is a huge statement, because everybody in classic movies always says 1939 was the year. That was the year. That was it. And so when I read this, I looked at it and I went, You know what I mean? How did I know? I mean, I'm just like, 1962? So how did you guys get to figure out that 1962 was the best year at the movies?
Who'd like to start here? I guess I will.
Exactly.
So basically, I was always a film buff and film lover, and I took classes and when I was in college, and then I actually wrote a couple of scripts that were never produced. I moved to to Los Angeles back in the 80s, and I was working in the industry. I was a film buyer for a theater chain, movie chain. Mm-hmm. And so I saw literally in my lifetime thousands and thousands of movies, and I was doing it professionally because I was making a business judgment about them.
Right.
Not only just aesthetic, but also commercial, whether the audience would buy them. By the meaning, watch them in a movie theater.
Right.
So, which is the way movies should be watched, by the way.
Yes.
Yes, which we all miss. But anyway, cut to the chase. So I'm living in Los Angeles, and I was introduced to Steven by a mutual friend, the director Bill Condon, and he said, "You two have something in common." And I said, "Oh, really? What's that?" He says, "Well, you both have told me that you think that 1962 was the best year in movies." And so that was the connection, and we hit it off, and we went from there. So Stephen, you can jump in here and you can
finish the story. The question is, what makes people choose their favorite year at the movies? And Bill Condon, who wrote the foreword to our book, theorized that a lot of it has to do with the years of first discovery during adolescence, as a teenager, the movies, when you first kind of fall under the spell of movies, that often the favorite year coincides with that period in your life. So I was a freshman in college in 62. So I don't know. I mean, maybe. I mean, Michael was a little younger than me. But so, I mean, that is certainly a factor that you're kind of beginning to discover things. And the reason, and I must say that I didn't instantly decide in 62 that was the greatest year.
Right, of course not.
It takes some other years of experiencing other movies, but I remembered certainly a lot of the movies of that year that impressed me tremendously. A Lawrence of Arabia, which won Best Picture.
Yes, and you guys do a very...
overwhelmed me when I saw it. In the roadshow engagement, I actually saw it in the beginning of 63, but it had been released at the end of 62. And other movies like The Manchurian Candidate,
oh boy. Yes.
And To Kill a Mockingbird, and Lolita, controversial movie, but all these movies, Sweet Bird of Youth, were absolutely fascinating to me at the time. And then as time went on and I began to compare more with other years, 1962 began to rise even more in my estimation as I kind of thought about the huge numbers of exciting films that came out that year. We speculate in the book that it may have had something to do with the JFK era, the new frontier, that it was a very exciting period in American society with like a youthful president who was sort of sweeping away the cobwebs from the 1950s,
right,
and advocating more active social involvement in civil rights and other issues. So that it was an interesting moment. It wasn't as kind of volatile as some of the later years in the 60s, but it definitely was a transitional period in terms of bringing a lot of urgent social issues to the fore. So, I mean, these were some of the factors, I think, that were in play in 1962.
And perhaps because, with the code and with all that stuff, so much could not have look, they couldn't have made Lolita in 1950. They couldn't have made a half of those things in Manchurian
right.
Canada in 1950. You could
right.
make these sort of movies now that they couldn't have made then. And also the
yeah.
studio era was coming to an end as well. I mean, it was still there, but it was really, you know, kind of coming apart to being something different.
Yes, and there were kind of new independent voices that
mm-hmm.
were coming to the fore in 62. You know, 1939, which, as you mentioned, has been a favorite year of many people, was kind of the heyday of the studio era.
Right.
That's when the studios were all riding high and at their peak, and there were a lot of high-quality movies being made by the studios in that era, and probably in 39 in particular. By 62, the studios were, because of the rise of television and other factors, the studios were kind of faltering a bit. So there were new voices that came in, newly independent filmmakers like John Cassavetes,
mm-hmm.
Shirley Clarke, Frank Perry and Eleanor Perry, who made A David and Lisa, one of the most popular independent movies up to that point. Also, there was a huge impact of foreign cinema, which didn't exist in 39, but it was partly because the studios were losing their hold that there was more appetite to bring in films from many other countries, and audiences rushed to see a lot of them, especially in the big cities, but also on college campuses
mm-hmm.
everywhere. So it was a greater diversity of movies, I think, that we started to see.
Precisely. And because it was the end of the studio era, most of the old moguls were either retired or either died at that point. And even among the great stars of the era, many of the male stars had all passed away recently. Humphrey Bogart, Gary Cooper, Clark Gable, Errol Flynn, Tyrone Power. They had all
very young. They were young. They were in their 50s.
They were all in their 50s.
Yeah.
Both Cooper and Gable both reached 60, but that was it. There was
mm-hmm.
60, and then they were gone. So we still have the great stars like Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne and Henry Fonda.
Right.
But there was this void there. And then among the women, they were not as active as the men because of the ongoing
ageism.
Absolutely. Ageism was personified by by Hollywood because they were matching the older men with the younger women. Like at the end of his career, Clark Gable was paired off with Doris Day, Sophia Loren, and Marilyn Monroe.
Mamie Van Doren and right, Teacher's exactly. Pet. People, you know, like, although yours were Doris. Yeah.
Correct. So it was a real challenge for the older stars like Barbara Stanwyck and Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Katharine Hepburn to find suitable roles, who had been the great leading ladies in the 30s and the 40s. And they had to really, really cast their nets wide to find something appropriate to play.
I have to say, though, don't you think Joan did pretty good in the 50s?
Well, she was the exception to the rule because the other well, that's not true either because of Katharine Hepburn, she did very well in the 50s as well. But like she always had an advantage over Betty and Joan because like she had already she had taken a bigger variety of roles than they had, so she had more choice. But even at that era, I mean, she hadn't made a movie. I mean, it was interesting about this, that both Joan and Betty and Olivia de Havilland, she had her last really good role in 1962, Light in the Piazza.
Love that movie.
They all made movies in 3 years. I mean, they were off the screen.
Yeah.
So they were still looking for those roles. They had really slowed down to a crawl. And so, yes, Joan did have better luck, but her luck ran out, too.
Right. So I think it was a best of everything. That was the last film Joan did that was sort of like and I think that was 59 or 60. And
she was 59. Like
59.
Yeah.
And she didn't even have the biggest part. It was just an ensemble cast. Right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they were concentrating on the younger actors.
Right.
Right. So
Diane Baker, Hope Lang, and the other one, Susie Parker. Yeah.
Right. So that was the plight of the older actresses, whereas the older actors, they didn't have as many of those problems because they were still getting roles and being matched off with younger actresses. So that was the state of affairs of Hollywood in that era. So the actresses had to look around and see what was what was available to them, and it was kind of slim pickings, unfortunately.
Didn't Betty take an ad out? I don't know what year it was, but she did.
Yes, in September in Variety, and she had just been on Broadway. She was in The Night of the Iguana by Tennessee Williams, and that didn't go well for her, even though she was very popular among audiences, but her fellow cast members resented the fact that she was so popular with audiences, and they felt it was disruptive to the performance because they used to cheer and when she first came out, you know, on stage, and she would acknowledge them. So I guess that was a faux pas, anyway. And so they didn't care for that. So she left the cast, basically. She did not find it a welcoming experience. And so she, in the ad that she took out, she said that she had Broadway and she wanted to go back to the movies and she was looking for parts. And
what year was that? Viable. 60 or 61?
62. It was September of 62. Yes, exactly.
Wow. And Baby Jane got made when?
A little after that, really. Right.
Exactly. She was actually filming. She was filming Baby Jane when she took out that ad.
Wow.
Because when they did Baby Jane, it was a lark because that was the best script that they could find, and they didn't know because all the studios passed on that movie. They wouldn't finance it. They felt that they were both box office poison at that point in their careers.
Old broads, as Betty would say.
Old broads, exactly. And so Robert Aldridge took a gamble. I mean, he had to go and he had to get outside financing. No, the studios would back it. Warner Brothers, Jack L. Warner, he agreed to distribute it. But he wasn't taking any chances that way because he didn't have the finance. That he just had to charge his distribution fees, which were pretty hefty actually. And you know, it's very interesting about how movies are financed and when we're financed in the area. So since he agreed to distribute the movie,
he got his money first before they did, before Robert Aldridge he took all of his share first, and then he gave them the net after that. So, and that's how the system works. It's a very interesting conundrum. So anyway.
But it shows, you know, you think of that when you look at that cast, you think, oh, this, and it was distributed by a studio. So you think of it as a studio movie, but it really wasn't. It was another example of how independent financing had taken over, or was starting to take over, Hollywood at that time, because that was the only way they could get that movie made, was by an independent company apart from the major studios. So it was a very low budget. It was budgeted at under $1 million, I think. Wasn't that true, Mike? So I mean,
a
lot less than the studios were spending on most of their movies at that time.
Precisely. So, it was Seven Arts which came to the rescue, actually. And there's a certain amount of irony in that, because later in the decade, Seven Arts took over Warner Brothers.
Right.
They emerged, because Warner Brothers was, had been to the point where Jack L. Warner basically sold out. So that was sort of an illustration of how the independents really rose in and took over Hollywood.
And that money made them a lot of money, didn't it?
That was a huge smash hit. I mean, they did do something right with that film. They decided to showcase it. It was supposed to be released originally in early 1963, and it was just going to be a regular film, and they would do their normal release pattern with it. But then they decided to do something different with it. They called it a Hollywood premiere engagement, and they offered it to exhibitors. They were going to give it to them 400 runs all at once. Now, this is an important factor about movie going in that era, is that every movie theater in the United States was a single screen theater. There were no twins, there were no multiplexes, no quads, no triples, no 20-plexes. They all
imagine
decades later. So you went to the movies, and it was your neighborhood theater, basically. So in that era, they would start in the downtown movie palaces, and then they would gradually go out into the neighborhoods. But with this film, they decided to offer it all at once across the country, 400 theaters.
Right.
So, and they a special engagement, and they let the exhibitors have a contest who could do the best promotions with it. So that's the one thing that helped, but it was the casting that really drove the box office, because look at the fan base for both Betty and Joan.
And they had never, when they were young, worked together. This is the first time they were in stage door canteen, I guess, just as extras or something like that, right?
They both had cameos.
Right.
And they didn't have, they didn't share a scene. So that's a technicality, that they've actually been in a movie together before. But no, they were co-stars.
Boy, were they co-stars. Claustrophobic co-stars.
And of course, everyone knows about the famous feud, and that was fueled by the miniseries from 2017.
I loved the miniseries. I loved it.
It was a lot of fun. But I have to point out that it wasn't completely accurate.
Well, I don't think it was completely accurate either, because they had to change certain people and do certain things. And, you know, you're making dialogue. You weren't in the room. So how do you know? You know, But I thought it was fun. I thought it was fun.
Yes, it was fun. I thought it was very well done for what it was. And, and let's face it, it revived interest in this movie, which has always been one of my personal favorites. I mean, I saw this film. This is another indication of the box office punch of this movie. So it did extremely well. It made all of its budget back in the first 10 days of its distribution.
Oh, wow.
Now, that was a real feat. So it grossed enough, and then it kept running, and it became one of the big, you know, box office hits of the year. And then it was still around. I mean, I saw it during Oscar season, because Oscar season was a little longer then, because the Oscars were in April of the following year.
Right.
The nominations came out in February. So they paired it off. So that was very common among the studios. They would do double features of their older films from a few years before, because they weren't making as many movies. And that was another point.
Because of television, right?
Because of television, mm-hmm. and they had drained a lot of the talent, the writers, the actors. They were making they were making television, not the top actors, but the contract players.
Yes,
Warner Brothers and the Universal. Those studios had a number of actors under contract, but they also were granting out television shows. So they were feeding them that way, and Fox, so over on the Fox lot. So in that era, they were the film had its impact on popular culture. It became a real phenomenon. And then it was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, which was a real surprise. Because
some people just thought it was campy, right? Some people were on the campy side. Others were, this is a great movie, and it's fun.
I mean, some people took it as a straight thriller,
right?
You know,
right.
A suspense film. Other people, you know, as an acting exercise. I don't think it became sort of a camp favorite until a few years later, because I don't know that audiences at that time were, there were a few sophisticated urban crowds that may have been aware of like the camp possibilities, but that I think took hold over the years as camp became more of a nationwide phenomenon, and then there were drag shows later,
yeah,
where performers were imitating Betty and Joan. So that took a little while. I think that at the time most people took it as a straight thriller and as an acting exercise for, you know, kind of reestablishing the power of these two stars from the golden age. Although, I mean, people commented that these weren't exactly the kind of prestige films that they had, prestige roles that they were known for. So there were some people who were kind of scratching their heads about that and felt, gee, this is a little bit of a come down for these prestigious,
yeah,
Academy Award winning actresses. But the public loved it, and
Betty gets nominated.
It caught on.
Betty got nominated for Best Actress, and who can forget,
yeah,
that? I mean, talk
right
about Joan being a biatch. She was terrible. She went to every other supporting actress, and she asked if she could. She went up for? I think she asked Geraldine Page. She asked Anne Bancroft.
Well, she was going to accept for any, yeah, of them, but Anne Bancroft. She accepted on behalf of Anne Bancroft, who won. And so she was photographed all over the place holding an Oscar.
And
so
she
that
looked
was, she
fabulous.
Got, like, one up on her co-star Betty.
Which was really
she
mean.
She actually got to hold an Oscar even though she hadn't won it. You know, whereas Betty was just standing in the wings watching.
Oh, that was really mean if you ask me. But Joan did look stunning. She even put the silver spray in her hair. I mean, she looked really good, but geez,
right,
that was,
yeah,
a really rotten
she
thing
did
to do, if you ask me. Between you, me, and the lamppost, but
There's something else that most people hadn't commented at the time, because in my research for the book and for the movie, I uncovered this fact: both Betty and Joan had autobiographies released in 62 while they were making Baby Jane. That's just a coincidence. I don't think they planned that. And with Betty called The Lonely Life, she got very good reviews. But Joan didn't get great reviews. So that may have fueled some of that jealousy going on.
Well, wasn't Joan's more about how to live Joan's lifestyle, sort of like to be polite and put out the perfect platters for dinner parties or,
yes,
you know, how
exactly.
to get that soap scum right. out was, of the, right. the toilet.
Right, right. It wasn't
know.
A frank,
no.
you know,
tell it like it is, right.
career, exactly, which is what Betty did. And the critics had admired that. And Joan, it was too superficial
right.
for them. So I think that may have fueled the fire.
Do you believe this Franchotone business started this feud?
You mean back in the 30s
right.
because of Dangerous and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that. I mean, I've read all the Betty bios and
Me
all
too.
The autobiographies and
Me
all
too.
Of that. And so, I mean, it's part of Hollywood lore, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? So
that Francho, he was quite, I'd love a biography on him. People think he was just a nice looking dude, but look at the women he chose and the lives he picked, Barbara Payton and all these other things. Francho was quite a character.
And of course, he wasn't a top star any
no.
longer in that era. I mean, he did have one very strong role at the end of his career, however. He played the ailing president in 7 Days in May 2 years later.
Oh,
in
1964.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really his best late career role.
No, not who are you talking about?
Franchotone.
No, he was in my Advising Consent. He played the president.
Oh, I'm sorry.
62 movie. He was not in 7 Days in May.
You're right. I got them.
Melvin Douglas was the president in 7 Days in May, right? Or no, that
was
the
actually,
one.
Frederick March was the president.
Oh, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I got my plots mixed up. I knew I was going there because of 62. As soon as you mentioned him, I said, oh, wait a minute. He's connected to 62. And thank you, Stephen, for correcting me. Yes, he was the ailing president in.
That was a great late role for him in The Greatest Year at the Movies, 1962.
Yes, and you guys
exactly.
mentioned this film.
There you are.
And
so,
this is, it has so much in it.
But just to broaden the discussion a little bit about the actresses, the one point that we make in the book is that, and Mike already mentioned it, that it was a hard time for older actresses getting parts because of the sexism and ageism in Hollywood.
Of course.
So this was... this was a rare exception of a movie with two older actresses that caught on with the public. And it did lead to a kind of a brief but kind of startling wave of horror movies starring older actresses
yes.
that were beneficiaries of the success of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. So for the next 10 years or so, a lot of the older actresses were able to get more work, maybe not the parts they would have
no.
ideally wanted, but it did have an impact. And, you know, there were other actresses like Barbara Stanwyck who had not a big part, but a very juicy, good part in 62 in Walk on the Wild Side.
Right.
Rosalind Russell also started in the 30s, and she had a great role in 62 in the movie version of Gypsy. But they were the exception. And Katharine Hepburn appeared in A Long Day's Journey and Tonight. But Hollywood was not really being that welcoming to older actresses at that point.
No, look at Tallulah Bankhead, Die, My Darling. Look at poor Joan in Straight Jacket.
Right,
you
right.
You know, the
right.
whole thing. And then they had her come out and like the hack thing. So, and her last film, Trog, and you could hear her You knew she was drunk. And I don't blame her. Trog. You know, I'd be drinking all through Trog myself. The hell, I'm not even trying to pretend it's Pepsi. Okay, Trog. You know, because that was terrible. But yeah. But as you
there was one actress who kind of defied the sexism of the industry in 62. She was, of course, not as old as these other great stars of the past, but we had one box office queen of 62, Doris Day, who was the biggest star of the year, according to the
I read that in your book.
Poll. Not just the biggest female star, the number one star of 1962. But she was an exception, I would say.
She was. She did A Touch of Mink, and Carrie was how old? 58.
Right.
And how old was Doris?
She was 38. She was 20 years younger.
You know what, though? With Carrie, you can buy. Because, you know, he's so handsome. He was so handsome. He looked young and fit. If I was 28, I would have gone out with him then. I don't care. He was so cute. Right.
Well, that's what Hollywood counted on.
Yeah.
Right.
But his career only lasted a few years after that because he decided to retire in 66 because he didn't like the prospect of being paired with these much younger actresses. I mean, he did it for a while, of course, all the stars did, but he began to feel that this was a little bit unseemly, even though, as you say, he could get away with it more.
And he was married to Diane Cannon, and then he married a woman who was about 29, his last wife. So in real life, he did it. But, you know, he could have gotten away with it because he maintained this regal thing. I believe it was when he did with Audrey Hepburn. He said that she had to go after him because he didn't want to like an idiot that he was chasing after her, but she had to go after him.
Right.
But I love Touch of Mink. I thought it was cute. And let's face it, Doris plays a virgin and Audrey Meadows as her virginal roommate. And I think Audrey was like 43. You guys would know her from The Honeymooners as Alice. But I still love that movie. And the person that made me laugh the most in that movie was Gig Young. He is hysterical in his supporting roles. He was wonderful.
Well, he was always a terrific asset to
a lot
of the movies that he
did. That was one of, precisely, and that was one of the reasons why it was, why she was the queen of the box office, because that was an incredible, enormous hit. It played for weeks and weeks and weeks at Radio City Music Hall in New York. I mean, it was grossing... grossed well over $1 million in its engagement there alone.
Just in one theater.
I have never been able to, you know, because since I moved to New York, I they weren't showing films at Radio City and Music Hall, but how cool that must have been, watching a film there.
Sure.
Like you said that, and another person who sort of escaped... I think you guys call this movie about hag, and I call it sort of the crone period that they make these poor women like crones, was Lana Turner. And Ava didn't do them either. Ava didn't do any of those.
Right. You're right. They didn't do them to their, well, I don't know. I have to say about that. I mean, they were both known were great beauties in their era. So that probably had some psychological effect on them. But neither one of them really, except for, this is just a little 6 degrees of separation. So Ava's last really good role was the role that Betty played on Broadway in
Maxine.
Night of the Iguana. Mm-hmm.
Right.
2 years later. And she was great in it.
Oh, I love her. It's one of my favorite roles she did. She was wonderful.
And there you go. And then she never made another decent movie after that.
That's true.
She made some popular movies like Earthquake and things like that.
But yes. Lorne Greene as her father and Charlton Heston trying to save her. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wanted to talk about, so you're talking about the women there. about a couple movies in particular, because as we talk about Night of the Iguana, Sue Lyon played the little nymphette who was just a terror and wanted Richard Burton, the defrocked priest, and of course the wonderful Grayson Hall, who Richard loved, and she was fabulous. And the whole cast was great. I can't say anything more about the cast. I read a really good book on the making of it. But Sue Lyon was there, and I thought she did that after Lolita.
She did.
She did.
When did Night of Iguana come out? 63?
64.
Ah.
64, right.
She got married that year. Yeah, so she did Lolita, which was a very famous book, and so many actors turned down the role of Humbert. What's his name?
Humbert.
Humbert. And they just didn't want to take the role. But, you know, I'm so glad James Mason took that role. I adore him. I adored him in that movie. What a movie. She was supposed to be 14, but she was 16 at the time. And still, to me, that's pretty scandalous. Shelley Winters, fabulous. And if you know what the Lolita story is, it's not a really long book, but it's interesting. And this man is not just he loves this girl, and there's pathos, and there's this and her and Shelley and him having sex with Shelley by looking at Lolita's picture. That's the only way you can have sex with Shelley.
Well, the movie was, you know, it was a hot potato, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it took them a few years to get the movie made because Stanley Kubrick had started working on the movie, wanted to do it even before he did Spartacus, which, he came in at the last minute on that because Kirk Douglas had fired the original director, Anthony Mann. And the success of Spartacus of 1960 helped to push Lolita forward. But he had, and his producing partner, James B. Harris, had actually begun working on Lolita even before Spartacus came out. They wanted to do it. But Kubrick, was one of the most important newer directors to emerge in 1962. He had done a couple movies before that, but he was, one of the exciting young Turks who were making a mark in the cinematic world. And Lolita had been a tremendously controversial novel. It was originally banned before it was finally approved to be distributed in the country. And it remains controversial today, in some ways even more controversial than it was when it was originally published in the 1950s. So it was a very scandalous book about a middle-aged man who has a love affair with a young teenage girl. And it's partly, as you said, a story of sexual desire, but becomes more than that when you realize that he really is deeply in love with her, cares for her tremendously, is willing to make sacrifices unselfishly for her. But it was, in a way, it would be probably even more controversial with audiences today than it was in 1962, but it was very controversial then, and it had to be restricted to audiences 18 or older in the U.S., which meant that Sue Lyon herself could not go to the premieres of the movie because she was too young, she was underage. And yes, there were other actors considered for the part of Humbert, Laurence Olivier, David Niven, but their agents told them, no, you can't play this part. This will destroy your career. You're going to be playing a child molester. So it was extremely controversial, but it was a brilliant piece of filmmaking by Kubrick and a brilliant script The casting
perfection.
Of the four main characters was superb. All of them did an outstanding job. James Mason, as you mentioned, really nailed the part, caught his humanity.
Yes.
As well as his somewhat creepy obsession. Lyon, you know, made an extraordinary job. Shelley Winters was hilarious in the part of her mother.
And heartbreaking towards the
Peter
end.
Sellers,
yes.
Which we have to mention him. He had a supporting part in the film, but it was a brilliant turn that everyone who saw the film commented on how much he brought to the movie.
He did.
And it was really, they built up the character of Quilty that he played, even from the book. And when they did the remake of the movie, years later with Jeremy Irons, that part was reduced tremendously because it wasn't that big a part in the book, but they wanted to make the most of Sellers. And the scenes with Sellers and James Mason are some of the most brilliant
scenes
of comic writing that you'll find in any movie of that era. It's just the kind of byplay between the two of them, superb acting, just at the highest level that you could imagine.
You know, don't you think he's underrated? Also, a lot of the guys, to me, it's like, what is wrong with you? They didn't want to be in A Star Is Born. Because it was Judy's movie, and he was not wanted to as the, he was like one of the last picks, but he was fabulous. He took roles and he shone. And I really like James Mason. I like Lolita. It's kind of, it grosses me out a bit, but you know,
yes.
I think it's just because of the acting. The production, everything just puts it together to be an amazing film. In 1962, like you said, with the Me Too and this and that, I agree with you. I do not think it would be really an easy sell today. What do you think, Michael?
When you watch it again, just some of the comic scenes are just, they're bold. But they're brilliant scenes. I mean, it just has some of the best comic writing and acting that you will find in any movie from that period. So if you can, not that you should put aside these other issues, of course they're important, but I think, you know, if you just look at the film in terms of comic writing and acting, it's one of the peaks of the whole era, not just 62.
I agree. I love that. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, and another really interesting point about that is that in 1962, that was a mainstream movie released by the studios, even though it was filmed, you know, by Kubrick in England. Mm-hmm. It was released by
MGM.
By MGM, a major studio. They gave it the full Royal Class A studio treatment, and it was a mainstream movie.
Was it a hit?
Yes, it was a huge hit.
It was a huge hit, and it made the top 20 for box office grosses for the year. And this is the point I'm coming to. When they remade it with Jeremy Irons, which was about 20 years ago, something like that. I can't remember the details. That was a specialized film. It was not a mainstream movie. It was not a wide release. It played in the art houses because I was, you know, I was at Landmark Theaters then, and it was an art film. So there's the difference between 1962 and and 40 years later, and their treatment of it, and also the reception that it was given. So
well, it wasn't. I never saw the Jeremy Irons version. I know I have a friend who saw it, and he said he likes that version better than the first one. You know, that's just opinions, but I never saw it. And
I don't agree. It has some merits. It's not without merit. Jeremy Irons, of course, is good.
Mm-hmm.
The young actress who they discovered also did a very good job.
Dominic Swain, I believe her name was.
Yeah. She looks younger than Sue Lyon. I don't think there was really that much difference in their age, but Sue Lyon looked a little older than she really was, which made it a bit easier for audiences to digest. But it missed the humor that was in the 1962 version, and I might say that was from the novel. It wasn't that they brought something to that movie that they made up. I mean, the humor was in the book. That was one of the things that made it such a brilliant piece of writing. And in the later version, maybe because they were nervous about the subject matter, they made it a much heavier drama, kind of a tragic drama. And it had that element in the 62 film as well, but the black humor, the very original, innovative humor of the 62 film was almost completely jettisoned in that later version.
I'll have to watch it someday, but I have yet to see that because it's like the same. Okay, this is another movie that I adored. There's so many really good movies. And when I said, to 62, I could get what you guys were saying because I didn't realize how many great movies were made in 62. This is one of my favorite movies. It's dark. It's not zippity-doo-dah. It is The Manchurian Candidate. John Frankenheimer, I love this film. I think the actors were perfection. It kills me. Angela Lansbury, what a beast. And she was only, what, 3 or 4 years older than Lawrence Harvey playing his mother?
Yes.
Even Jim, what was the name? The guy who played her doofus husband. James Gregory.
Yeah.
He was great as well.
Right, yes. He really caught the, played up the humor. You mentioned earlier, I just want to follow up on this point, that these movies could not have been made a few years earlier. And that is very true of A Manchurian Candidate, not so much because of the sexuality, that wasn't the issue there, but because it made fun of the a McCarthyite right-wing politicians who were, nobody would have made fun of them in the 1950s. They were really holding sway. They were very powerful.
They could, so well, look at how many careers they put on.
Yeah, they were very destructive, and nobody wanted to cross them by mocking them. And John Frankenheimer said that was one of the things that appealed him about this story, was that nothing had been done to really attack the McCarthyite tactics of destroying people's lives in the name of protecting America from communism. So you couldn't have made that movie 5 years earlier because of the fact, and even in 62, it was still a hot potato, and conservative groups like the American Legion attacked the movie for being anti-American and making fun of patriotic Americans like this right-wing Republican senator played by James Gregory, as you mentioned, and Angela Lansbury, who, of course, she's not really a fervent anti-communist. She's pretending to be able to take control of America for Russia and China. Does this theme sound a little bit timely
now? Yeah, it's unbelievable, really.
Yes, it is.
Pretty scary.
In 1962, this was a fantasy, and now it's reality. So
it's amazing, and I love all the actors. John MacGyver, who is always good. I mean, he usually plays humorous parts, but he was adorable and great as a senator, who is the father of the woman that Lawrence Harvey marries. Lawrence Harvey's mother is the Beast. And they have kind of a sick relationship, but it's amazing because people wake up in cold sweats. Frank Sinatra stars, and along with Janet Leigh, had a small part, but you know what? She was good too. It wasn't anything big, but it was very, everybody had their little part.
Well, you know, I heard a funny story not that long ago that the screenwriter, George Axelrod, had some fun with that romantic subplot with Janet Leigh and Frank Sinatra because he didn't really want to include it. But, you know, they felt, well, you have to have a romance in a popular movie, and it really didn't have anything to do with the main story. So he deliberately made it made these scenes between the two of them kind of, you know, off the wall, non sequitur comic scenes, just to send up the whole idea of the conventional movie romance. They have this very weird kind of dialogue between them. It's not at all typical of romantic subplots in movies. It had an absurdist tone to it, which I think Axelrod was making, tweaking the whole genre a bit. But that was just sort of an aside of the movie, because it's mainly a suspense thriller, but with some unexpected humor. And we have to mention a little more about Angela Lansbury as you said, Lawrence Harvey's mother, but the arch villain of the story, who's really plotting the communist takeover of the country. And it was a very bold role to have, you know, played by a woman, to make her, not that we hadn't had female villains before.
She was one of the best.
But they were usually using their sexuality
to take down a man,
male character, in order to usually make money. That was their motive. Her motive was much grander than
power,
that. She wanted to
take
over the entire country,
right,
and not just for her communist sponsors, but for herself.
For
the final scene when she's sort of coaching Lawrence Harvey to assassinate the main presidential candidate, she tells him, you know, when I take power, these other people are going to be ground to dirt for what they've done to you and what they've done in so contemptuously underestimating me. I can quote the scene because it's such good dialogue. Anyway, so that was, and a lot of people see the film now and they, boy, that's an interesting character for 1962, this powerful woman who wants to rule the country. It was an unthinkable idea.
And uses her son.
Time, but
uses her
son. She's such a powerful villain.
Yes, uses her son, lets him, they get captured and they are in a place. And it's fascinating because, as you said, there was a guy that was in the platoon, Lawrence Harvey, I guess, was the leader of the platoon. And in real life, in the movie, they say nobody could stand him. But whenever they say he is the bravest, most wonderful man in the world, you know, they would just say it. And Frank Sinatra woke up with these nightmares that he'd have that were so real he'd wake up sweating. And then one of his black friends, who's a soldier, wrote to Frank and said, do you have any of this happening and whatever? And it's like you wouldn't believe. They get brainwashed and they think that they're seeing women at some like garden club or whatever. And it's just unbelievable. And like I told you guys, I do hypnosis. And, you know, brainwashing is so different, you know. And when with hypnosis, allegedly, this is what they say, that you cannot make someone do something that is against their principle.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't say if I was going to hypnotize you right now, Michael or Stephen, go rob a bank. Don't hurt anybody, but bring me all the money. Okay. You couldn't do that even, or something like that. But in this, it's really, people are brainwashed. We are brainwashed. And right. This is what I tell people who I do hypnotize. You watch commercials, you're brainwashed. The ads are brainwashing you. We're constantly being brainwashed. You watch your Fox News, you're being brainwashed. You're watching any news, you're being brainwashed every single day of our lives. And this guy, I don't know. It's just, it's chilling. The movie is chilling. And like, it's just so, like, you wouldn't believe we are actually thinking of something like this is happening today. It's unbelievable that we would be actually thinking that this would actually happen or could actually happen.
Right. At the time, it was very prescient because it was about an assassination of a presidential candidate. But, and then 1 year later, of course, we had
we had the Kennedy assassination. And so then it was shelved. It was out of release for several years thereafter and not re-released until the 80s.
Wow. I didn't know that. Well, yes, I know I didn't see it until I think probably the 90s.
Looking at it now, not only was it prescient about that, but it was also prescient about what's going on right now. So this is a multi-layered, multi-textured movie that has a lot in it. So it's certainly worth looking at again.
Oh, right now. You know, I never saw I don't like remakes. I never saw the Manchurian Candidate that they did with Denzel Washington, Liev Schreiber, and Meryl Streep.
Right.
Did you guys watch it?
Yeah,
I saw it. It was not as good as the original by any means. Just as these remakes, yes. I mean, Lolita, as we said, it was not as good as the original. Yeah. Manchurian Candidate did not compare with the original.
Right. And even Cape Fear also.
Yes. I love what you wrote about Cape Fear. You were so
right. And that was remade, in 30 years later. And that wasn't nearly as good.
No,
so,
you were right. No. Robert De Niro totally went over the top.
He
was so scary. Max Cady, played by Robert. One of my dreamboats. What's his name?
Robert Mitchum.
Who I adore. He was so good, scary, so seedy, and just like in The Night of the Hunter. What a wonderful villain he played. But he did not go over the top. He didn't become any of that. It's scary. It still scares me, his performance. And I loved it. I thought that was a great movie in 62. Another one we can mention, To Kill a Mockingbird. Unfortunately, it seems that times.
Yes, there were a lot of great ones.
Yes. And it seems that, sometimes you think things are going to get better and they get better and then they don't change, do they, sometimes? But it was a beautiful movie. The acting superb. So many great movies. Freud, you guys were talking about, which was not one of my favorite movies because I am not a fan of Sigmund Freud and his theories, which we know now were, come on. He was a little weird himself.
Questionable, at least.
You want sex with your mother and your father.
Word.
And your brush and your ice cream cone. Oh, get lost, will you? I don't know what I want. And I certainly don't want that. Anyway, but you guys talk about Westerns, you talk about homosexuality, how it hits certain things. One, I think that was done really well was Victim with
Dirk Bogarde.
He was great. And it was such a good movie. And him being a gay male, I thought it was very brave of him at that time to take on that role.
Right.
It was very good. There were just too many. You guys, I would just say, read this book and you will go to yourself, hey, man, I went, and then I started seeing and reading and there's behind the scenes stuff and all this great stuff. You're going to get a lot of entertainment out of this book and learn a lot about the films, make you want to watch the films if you haven't or rewatch them again. And they make a good case for 1962 there. I got to say, you guys really did. And
well, thank you. That's what we hope people would
I love the book. Love the book. And you know what else, everybody? If it's just really something you can look back on if you're watching a movie. I love these kind of books because they're sort of like a reference book as well. I'm watching this movie. Oh, yeah, I read it in here. Let me look this up. So it's not just a fun, interesting book to read. It teaches you a lot. And for reference, if you ever need to look something up about a movie in 62 or whatever, it's perfect. And it gave me much pleasure to read. So I want to thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us and for being such a fan of the book. We appreciate it.
It's a really good book. And you guys are great.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for your endorsement. And for further information, your audience can go to our websites, our respective websites, stephenfarber.com and
M.R. McClellan, MrMcClellan.com. And you can, and there's even more information about the book and where to get it and events with our book tour. It's a virtual book tour these days.
Cool. I know, as everybody has to do. Tell everybody again the name of the book, Cinema 62.
The Greatest Year at the Movies.
Yes. And I'll tell you, you'll be like me. But then I read a few things like Leonard Maltin, he was saying, he said, huh, too. And he said, you guys made a good case. And I think that's what you can do. And you work together beautifully. And this book is just really, I enjoyed reading it. Really enjoyed it.
Great.
Thank you so much, Grace.
And I love having you on. And if you ever want to come on again and talk some other movies of 62, I am game. Because we didn't touch on a lot of them, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, we didn't.
There's more to say.
Yes. So I would be delighted. So thank you, Stephen Farber and Michael McClellan. You guys are swell. And thank you to everybody for listening. And stay safe. Bye, everybody. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye, guys. Thanks.
Bye.